I just did a little bit of breath meditation there towards the end, and one of the reasons I want to do that is because not this next sutta, but the sutta after that is the Anapanasati Sutta. And the Anapanasati Sutta is the sutta in all the discourses of the Buddha that really talks about breath meditation. So this really gets you into what breath meditation is all about. But before we get to the Anapanasati Sutta, I want to do this other one, which is called the Soil Remover. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya, and it has a few interesting points about meditation practice as well. So before we move on to the actual, the real meditation, if you like, there's a little bit more about defilements and how to overcome defilements so that you're ready, the mind is ready for the real thing, so to speak. And after that, the last half an hour or so, I'll do a bit of question and answers from the basket over here. So this is the Soil Remover. And this is an extract from this sutta. It's not the full sutta, but it's the part that I wanted to focus on for this evening here. So it goes as follows. Monks, there are gross defilements of gold, soil, grit, and gravel. Now the soil remover or his apprentice first pours the gold into a trough and washes, rinses, and cleans it. When that has been removed and eliminated, there still remain middle-sized defilements in the gold, fine grit and coarse sand. The soil remover or his apprentice washes, rinses, and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, there still remain subtle defilements in the gold, fine sand and black dust. So the soil remover or his apprentice washes, rinses, and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, only grains of gold remain. The goldsmith or his apprentice now pours the gold into a melting pot and fans it, melts it, and smelts it. But even when this has been done, the gold is not yet settled, and the dross has not yet been entirely removed. The gold is not yet malleable, wieldy and luminous, but still brittle and not properly fit for work. But as the goldsmith and his apprentice continues to fan, melt and smelt the gold, a time comes when the gold is settled and the dross has been entirely removed, so that the gold becomes malleable, wieldy, luminous, pliant and properly fit for work. Then, whatever kind of ornament the goldsmith wishes to make from it, whether a bracelet, earrings, a necklace, or a golden garland, he can achieve his purpose. So you have quite a famous simile in the suttas. And of course, the point here is that just as you remove the defilements of gold stage by stage to get pure gold, in the same way, you also remove the defilements of the mind stage by stage, starting with the grosser ones. And that is what is happening then next. The Buddha then brings out the other side, what actually you're supposed to be doing with your mind. So too, monks, when a monk is devoted to the higher mind, there are in him gross defilements, bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. An earnest, capable monk abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. When this has been done, there remain in him middling defilements, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. When this has been done, there remain in him subtle defilements, thought about his relations, thoughts about his country, and thoughts about his reputation. An earnest, capable bhikkhu abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. When this has been done, then there remain thoughts connected with the Dhamma. That concentration is not peaceful and sublime, not gained by full tranquilization, not attained to unification, but is reined in and checked by forceful suppressing the defilements. So this is here, in brief, the gradual abandoning of defilements. There are some interesting points here that this particular passage brings out that the other passages we have seen so far don't. And the first, of course, is the idea of gradualness. And as you can see here, it starts off with the very coarse defilements, what he calls here bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. And this obviously refers to things like, you know, in particular, of course, breaking precepts, breaking a conduct that is appropriate for whatever you're doing, whether you are a layperson, or you are eight precepts, or you are a monk or a nun or whatever. So these are the gross things. And the mental misconduct here, I take it to mean basically very coarse, or coarse at least, aspects of ill will and desire. So strong cravings and strong ill will is what I think is meant by mental misconduct in this particular case. And for those of you who have read a lot of Dhamma, you will know that there is such a thing as the 10 courses of wholesome and unwholesome action in the suttas. And 3 of those courses are the mental wrong action. And the mental wrong action are, in particular, the ill will, the desire, is called covetousness sometimes in that particular case, wrong view is the last one. So it is particularly that desire, the craving, and the ill will, I think, that is meant here, the strong aspects of those. So you start off with abandoning that. And that, of course, part and parcel of that is keeping what we know as the 5 precepts as a lay Buddhist. And then, when you have done that, then come the middling defilements. And of course, actually, before I say that, I should say that, again, you see what appears to be very strong language here. He says that the capable bhikkhu, in other words, somebody who is diligent and who is earnest and heedful and practicing properly, it uses the words abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates these negative things. And again, if you don't know what is going on here, it sounds like somebody is using an enormous amount of willpower to crush these things to smithereens so they never have to rise again in the future. That's what it sounds like. Obliteration, to me, is a very strong word. But of course, and with these words, the Pali words behind this, are actually the same Pali words that we saw in the first sutta, the 2 kinds of thoughts. And the way they are used there is not in terms of willpower. They are used in terms of understanding the danger of these thoughts, the danger of these actions and speech, and abandoning by understanding the danger, understanding how it reduces wisdom, understanding how it's painful in the mind, understand how it is basically an enormous problem. And when you understand that, then that obliteration happens. And somebody pointed out to me today that the reason why, probably why it's called by these strong words, is because once you have the understanding, once you have the insight, and you give rise to that insight, then the defilement vanishes like that. It's like an obliteration, but not an obliteration through willpower, but through right attitude and right way of thinking. That is an enormous difference. So please keep in mind that sometimes you have to be careful in your interpretation, understanding of these Dhamma issues. It does not always mean exactly what it might seem to refer to. So then, once you have abandoned these serious and gross defilements, then you move on to the middling defilements. And these are then the sensual thoughts, the thoughts of ill will and thoughts of harming that we saw in the first sutta that we were reading here. So these are called the middling thoughts. So these then are not the grossest kind of mental misbehavior, but the kind of general desires, the general ill will and harming that people have in their mind on a fairly regular basis. I think everybody has these kind of issues coming up many, many times during the day, in an ordinary day. So this is then the second aspect. And again, terminate them, dispel them, and abandon them by wisdom power, not by willpower. So again, it's the same kind of aspect that you're using here, by understanding these things properly. So you can see the refining of the mind, stage by stage. And sometimes this is a thing that happens over months and years of practice. Of course, it seems very fast when you read it in a sutta like this, but it's a gradual refining of the mind. And it is one of the best ways as a practitioner of the Dhamma to understand whether you are going in the right direction is to look back in your life. Look back a few months, look back a few years, and see what is happening to your mind. And if you see that you're becoming more pure, your mindfulness is becoming more established, you're becoming a kinder and gentler person, then you know that is working. And this process is actually happening inside of you through your practice. And then comes, and as you then become more mindful, you become calmer down, you become more kind, etc., etc., also your insight into yourself improves along the way. You understand your defilements better. You start to see the more refined defilements in your mind. And that gives you then the ability to overcome those new defilements. First of all, you have to see them. You have to understand that they're there before you can actually overcome them. You have to see that there's some obstacle there in your mind. Then you can move on to overcome these things. And then eventually, when you start abandoning even those desires and ill wills, then the very subtle defilements remain. Thoughts about relations, thought about country or place of birth, and thought about your reputation. Thought about your reputation is like thinking about what other people think about you. Are they concerned? You know, what do they think? Are you making a good kind of... Are you getting a good reputation among other people? Are you sort of, you know, how do other people think about you, basically? This is a big hassle in life. Always have to think about others, what they think, rather than just allowing yourself to be yourself, not having to worry about what other people think. And this, of course, is one of the things that happens as you practice the spiritual path. The more pure you are inside of yourself, the more sure you are that you are coming from the right place, you know that you are coming from purity, the less you care what other people think. It doesn't matter anymore because you know that inside of yourself you are coming from the right place and you're not worried about what other people think. And this is one of those great freedoms that comes as part of this path. And this happens in particular at this particular stage when you, to a large extent, even give up your sense of identity here. You don't worry about your relations. You don't worry about your country. You don't worry about what other people think because your purity is already so profound at this stage. So this is, here you can see that you're also abandoning to some extent your sense of self because our reputation and where we come from and all these things are our part of our identity badge, who we think we are. You know, we are Australian or we are whatever, and we have a certain background, a certain education, we have certain relations or whatever. All of that is sort of thrown out of the window. It doesn't matter anymore. Who cares about those things? All I want to do is be peaceful. And this is what happens at this stage. And this is one of the great things about coming here to the retreat center. You don't have to be anybody here. You can just be yourself. And how wonderful and relaxing it is to just have to be oneself, not have to prove anything to anybody. One of the great things that is supposed to happen on a meditation retreat. So at this point then, you abandon also these things. And then it says here, at that point, you have basically abandoned all desires and negative states of mind. And all that remains, it says here, are thoughts connected with the Dhamma. Actually, this phrase in the Pali is Dhamma Vitakka, and it can be rendered in many ways. And I prefer the translation thoughts that are aligned with the Dhamma, or thoughts that are I think thoughts that are aligned with the Dhamma is an acceptable translation there. In other words, not just thoughts connected with the Dhamma, because thoughts that are connected with Dhamma can be of all kinds of types, but thoughts that are in accordance with the Dhamma, they accord with the Dhamma. So in other words, the thoughts of renunciation, the thoughts of kindness, the thoughts of goodwill towards other people, the equanimity, the metta, the compassion, all these kind of things. Those are the thoughts that are aligned with the Dhamma. The type of thoughts that you will remember from the first sutta, the Buddha said, there is nothing to fear from these kind of thoughts. These are the thoughts that he is talking about at this stage. And once you get there, the mind is becoming very peaceful already. So these are then thoughts that accord with the Dhamma, is what I would call these thoughts here, rather. And then he says, that concentration is not peaceful and sublime, not gained to full tranquilization, not attained to unification, but is reined in and checked by forceful suppression of the defilements. So it's interesting, he's calling that already a type of samadhi, a concentration, because the mind is becoming very pure. It is very close to samadhi at this stage. Samadhi is like the mind unifying, and you're becoming very, very focused on your object. And he's saying it's not yet peaceful and sublime. In other words, it's not yet fully attained to samadhi. It's like a pre-stage of samadhi, an early type of samadhi. It's not gained to full tranquilization. Full tranquilization, again, is when the mind doesn't move, is fully unified with the object. Not attained to unification, is basically more of the same. And the last part here is quite interesting. It's not reined in and checked by forceful... it is reined in and checked by forceful suppression. So the point here, I think the word suppression might be too strong. It's more like that you have an active control of what is going on. So the point here is that, as what we have seen so far, is that we're trying to overcome the defilements. And as long as we're trying to overcome the defilements, there is still a certain activity of the mind going on. There's still a use of the will, use of the volition to think in the right way, to turn your mind in the right direction. Very subtle, perhaps, but still a little bit of willpower there. And that is what he's saying here, is that at this point, because there are still thoughts that accord with the Dhamma, maybe very beautiful thoughts, very kind thoughts or whatever, but there is still, the mind is still active. The mind is still in charge, trying to sort of, you know, move you slightly in the right direction. A little bit this way, a little bit that way. When you see a bad thought coming up, you think to yourself, can I look at this in a different way? So it's still a slight movement of the mind. And what this means, basically, is that the will is still active at this stage. And this is quite an unusual expression in the suttas. This expression in Pali is a very kind of long-winded and unusual expression in the Pali. But it uses the word sankhara, which means will. So prior to real samadhi, the will is still active. And this is the point I'm trying to make here. The will is still active prior to reaching full samadhi. And this is what happens next. So now we get into very, very deep stages here. Next thing that happens is, the Buddha says, but monks, there comes a time when his mind becomes internally steady, composed, unified, and concentrated. That concentration is peaceful and sublime, gained by full tranquilization and attained to unification. It is not reined in and checked by forceful suppression of the defilements. So here, this is the time when you keep on practicing like this. Eventually, you attain this thing which is perfectly tranquilized, a concentration that is peaceful and sublime, and attained to unification. Unification here is the Pali word ekodibhava, which means unified. And this is a description of the jhana states, where the mind is fully unified. And of course, what is interesting here, the way it is described here, is that it is not reined in and checked by the activity of the will. Na sa sankhara, not with the sankharas, not with the will. And this is one of those things that shows in the suttas, that once you attain a jhana is beyond the activity of the will, beyond the control of the will, beyond volition. And I don't know if you can really relate to this so well, but for me it is very interesting, because with samadhi and with these profound experiences, there's always lots of people debating this way, what are they, what are they not? Either, you know, some people say jhana, you just sit there and you feel a bit of bliss, other people say it's very profound. Who is right? And sometimes you come across these statements in the sutta that give you a very clear guidance to what these things actually are. And this is one of those guiding statements. It says very clearly here that there is no will in operation at this point. And certainly that's how I understand this particular paragraph. So it is actually quite a useful way for understanding what the deep samadhis really are about. So if there is no will in operation, what does that mean? You can imagine if there's no will, it means that you are completely still. There's nothing moving anymore. Not only is there nothing moving, but nothing can move. You cannot do anything because the will is out of action. That's basically what it means. So extremely profound states of mind. And then, I won't go any further into that, but then the Buddha says, then there being a suitable basis, he is capable of realizing any state realizable by direct knowledge towards which he might incline his mind. So here he's basically just saying that once you get to that point, you have attained the deep samadhi, then you're ready for profound insight. That's basically that. So that is the Soil Remover Sutta. And just a few interesting points from that sutta. And now we come to the main sutta. And this is like, now we really get to meditation proper. So far we have been looking at the preparations for meditation. Now we come to the real meditation sutta. And this is, as far as meditation is concerned, one of the most important ones, I think, in the Pali canon. It talks about breath meditation, mindfulness of breathing, Anapanasati Sutta. And again, this is just an extract. It's not the whole sutta, because the whole sutta has a lot of material which is maybe not so relevant right now. But this is the main aspect of the actual breath meditation itself. So, there's a small introductory part, and it goes as follows. Monks, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. When the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors of awakening. When the seven factors of awakening are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true wisdom and deliverance. So this is the promise of mindfulness of breathing. And in particular, the very first statement here, to me, is very important. It says that when you develop mindfulness of breathing, you fulfill the four foundations of mindfulness. And that is very important, because people often wonder, how should we practice the foundations of mindfulness? These are the satipatthanas, sometimes called the focuses of mindfulness, which I quite like as a translation. But the satipatthana is a whole series of different exercises. And people often wonder, how should we practice this? And here it is told in a very simple way that the way to fulfill, to complete, to accomplish these satipatthanas fully and completely is simply by watching the breath. That's enough. And you can finish off the satipatthanas just by doing that much. And that is very useful, because it gives you a very clear guideline for how to do these things. There is more to satipatthana than just watching the breath. But watching the breath is actually sufficient in its own right. Makes this whole thing much simpler than it's sometimes made out to be. And then, of course, then they in turn fulfill the seven factors of awakening, and then they fulfill what is here called true knowledge and deliverance, which is like the full awakening potential that Buddhism talks about. So, mindfulness of breathing takes you all the way to awakening. So, a very powerful type of meditation. That is why it is so important. And it's not, when I say that a meditation practice like this is important, I don't say that on the basis of this sutta alone. The way that you decide that something is important in the suttas is if you see it talked about again and again in different contexts, in different places, and Anapanasati, the mindfulness of breathing, is talked about again and again, different contexts, different ways, and because of that, it is important. That is how you decide the importance of something in the suttas. Not just because you have some kind of personal whim. And I recommend you also to read the suttas in that way. You know the importance by how frequently it is actually talked about. So, mindfulness of breathing takes you to full awakening. It's a very powerful type of meditation. And it is said that the Buddha himself used mindfulness of breathing to attain awakening as well. So then the Buddha goes on and he says, how, bhikkhus, is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? So these are the Buddha's instructions on how to develop mindfulness of breathing. Here, a monk gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, sets his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him. Ever mindful, he breathes in. Ever mindful, he breathes out. Now that passage is very important because this sets the context. It sets the framework, the basis on which mindfulness of breathing is practiced. And you will see here, what is interesting here is that it starts off by saying, gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut. So good on you, everybody who is here. You've gone to the forest at least. So you're going in the right direction. We can see here how important it is to have that sense of seclusion and solitude if you want to go really deep in meditation practice. And that is why you will find that the traditional forest monasteries are always in the forest. That's why monks and nuns usually have individual huts in the forest to practice on their own so that meditation can be taken as deep as possible. And this is why monastic life is so useful for practicing the Buddha's teaching. It's actually, rather I should say, it's one reason why it is so useful, because it gives you that physical the physical ability, so to speak, to practice this path properly, because it gives you that heart. It gives you the support to do these kind of things. And this is one of the powerful, very useful things that monasticism actually does for you. So here you see straight away the importance of solitude, the importance of being by yourself. Of course, initial aspects of meditation can be done in a group. Group meditation has its benefits, because sometimes everybody pulls everybody else along, and you feel good about that. It gives you a bit more oomph in your meditation practice. But eventually, solitude is really required. And you can see that also from the other aspects we've been talking about before. We talk, for example, about non-desire before and renunciation. And of course, monastic life is a much more suited for that sort of non-desire and renunciation that is required for deep meditation. Much more difficult to do that in lay life when you're bombarded with all kinds of things all the time. Monastic life is made particularly for that sort of renunciation that is necessary, that you have to be able to enter deep samadhi. So this is all about solitude. And then it says you sit down. So meditation happens when you sit down. That is like because you are sitting still, you're not moving anywhere, and that is when you can become peaceful. Walking meditation is also talked about in the suttas, but usually you don't do the very peaceful meditations while you walk. I know that some people say you can do breath meditation while you walk. Perhaps you can, but I would say breath meditation, and this is the point made here, essentially is a sitting practice. You do it when you sit down, because it's so subtle, such a refined thing, and you have to be really at peace to be able to do this. So it is a sitting practice. It doesn't say how you should sit. You can sit any which way, basically, but you should sit down. And you will notice sometimes people talk about the four postures of meditation, standing and lying down. But really, the suttas only talk about two postures, either walking or sitting. Standing and lying down is not really a posture of meditation. It is a posture. It is more like in the Satipatthana Sutta, you're supposed to be aware of your postures, whatever they are. It doesn't mean that these are meditation postures. It just means that you have awareness in daily life according to how your body is disposed. So, two types of meditation, sitting and walking. And this, Anapanasati, is all about sitting. And then he says, having folded his legs crosswise. So what does that mean? Does that mean you have to sit on a mat and fold your legs like they have done in India for many thousands of years? Or does it mean you can sit in other postures? And I say that the reason why it says that here is because that was the way they were comfortable in the time of the Buddha. I read recently an interesting passage about a nun who was ill. This is from the Vinaya Pitaka, about the nun's rules. And it said in that rule that this nun could find no comfort unless she was sitting cross-legged. And from that, it occurred to me that surely what that means is that cross-leggedness, just like in certain Asian countries until very recently, maybe even certain places even now, there are places where people normally sit on the floor, and they sit cross-legged, and they are used to that, and that is how they're comfortable. In the same way, in India 2,500 years ago, the reason they did that was because they were comfortable in that particular position. So what it means, having folded legs crosswise, doesn't mean you have to fold the legs crosswise. What it actually means is sit in a comfortable position. That is how I read this passage. So sit in a comfortable position is how I would translate it. Not maybe translate, but how I would interpret this passage. Then you have sets his body erect. And of course, the point is that if you are erect, you have more clarity in the mind. If you slouch a little bit, the clarity starts to disappear. The more erect you are, the more clarity you have. So you don't want to... that is basically the what is behind that one. So you sit reasonably straight. And then it says, established mindfulness in front of him. And this is the interesting thing here. He says, in other words, you sit down, you get ready for meditation, and the first thing you do is to establish mindfulness in front of you. So how do you do that? And this is what I've talked about until now, is basically how you establish mindfulness in front of you. And you don't do that, and this is my point so far, you don't do that through an act of willpower, saying, I'm going to be right here, right now. You don't do that, you cannot really do that in any other way, apart from this long course of practice, whereby gradually you purify yourself. And when you are on a meditation retreat, you take that purification a little bit extra by practicing metta and kindness and generosity, or whatever it is, on the retreat. And then you build up that mindfulness through this kind of practice. And then you just learn to relax. You learn to be at ease. You learn to enjoy the peace, to enjoy all these other good things. And then the mindfulness arises all by itself. And that is how you establish mindfulness, not by force. And this is so important. I read about people who teach about mindfulness practices around the world, and they say mindfulness is good, and mindfulness has all these great benefits, and it's a wonderful tool, and if you do this, you will have such results, etc. But very few people say, how do you actually become mindful? How do you improve your mindfulness in the long run? How do you practice that over the years, mindfulness actually increases? Nobody says that. And I think the reason they don't say it is basically because they don't know. The only way you find out is either through your own practice of these things in a deep way, or by reading the suttas and then seeing how the Buddha taught these things. And that is how you come to understand how mindfulness is established. So that is what you do. So if you sit down and you see that you have defilements in the mind, the first thing you have to do is to overcome those defilements. And then mindfulness happens. If it doesn't happen, it means you haven't been practicing long enough yet, in general, for overcoming those defilements. So that is what it means to having established mindfulness in front of you. And this idea of in front of you, the Pali word is parimukha. Parimukha literally means something. Mukha means face or mouth. And parimukha is then related to the face or related to the mouth. So I think it's quite satisfactory to say, having established it in front of you. In front of you means here and now. In other words, at this time, right now, you're not thinking about the past or the future, even if it is without defilements, even if it is a valid way of thinking about the past. You are in the present moment right now, and you are here, right here. You're not actually, your mind isn't somewhere else, it's right here in front of you. This is where you have your awareness, this is where you have your attention. And that, of course, is what you find. When you do find that you start to calm down, and the breath appears somewhere here in front of you. That's roughly where you tend to feel the breath. And that is then where your awareness is. That is what it means to have established mindfulness in front of you. Sometimes people say that you're supposed to focus on the tip of the nose or on the upper lip or on your stomach and all these kind of things. And you can do all those things if you like. But I like the idea that it's just mindfulness in the present. And you just know the breath. It doesn't matter where you know the breath. You just know the breath. It doesn't have to be in a particular place on the body or anything like that. And that is how Ajahn Brahm teaches, and I really find that teaching very useful, because it can become very narrow if you just focus on a particular point of the body. And then it says, ever mindful he breathes in, ever mindful he breathes out. So you have established mindfulness, so because established mindfulness is established, you breathe in. And then that breath, with that breath, mindfulness is there. The word ever here, the reason why they have put in the word ever is because there's a small Pali word which is called eva. And eva is like an intensifier in the Pali. Sometimes it is an intensifier, but sometimes it also just means only or simply or just. And that, I think, is a much better translation here. He is just mindful. So just mindful or only mindful or simply mindful. He breathes in and he breathes out. Ever mindful gives this idea that you are mindful all the time. But at this point, it's still early in the meditation practice. You're not yet ever mindful. If you were ever mindful at this point, there wouldn't be any purpose to many of the exercises afterwards. What it means is just mindful. What is just mindful? It means just aware, no control. No trying to have the breath this way or that way. But just mindful, just awareness, nothing besides the awareness. That, I think, is the appropriate translation here. Sattova, sattova, satto is mindful. Va eva is this thing which means only or simply here. And then you have, he breathes in and he breathes out. So that is the background, and that is how you get ready for the awareness of the breath or the breath meditation. And once you have done that, I'll go on a little bit longer, then the breath meditation proper starts. I'll wait on that for a minute or two. So this is then how the Buddha describes the breath meditation. Breathing in long, he knows I breathe in long. Breathing out long, she knows I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he knows I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, she knows, I breathe out short. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of the breath. She trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of the breath. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. This is like the bodily activity. She trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily activity. I don't want to make this too gender-specific, because if it's always he, more than half the people here might feel a bit excluded. This, of course, is not gender-specific. So, the first part here, breathing in long, he knows I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he knows I breathe out long. So what is going on here? Well, the point of this is simply that all at this stage, your awareness is not yet very powerful. So all you do at this stage, you have enough awareness to know whether the breath is long or short. You have enough awareness to be able to see every breath, whether it's long or short. I think long or short are used here because they are very simple qualities of the breath. But it could be any quality of the breath. You have enough awareness to know that much about the breath. That is quite easy to do, because sometimes you have a long breath or you have a short breath, and it's not that hard. It takes only a little bit of attention to be aware of that much. So this is just a pointer to the fact that the awareness is still quite weak, and you are only able to know that much about the breath. And then breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. So long and short breaths. And maybe, I don't know if this is true, but you can see here the long breath comes first and the short breaths come afterwards. And many people say that when they do breath meditation, they find as the meditation becomes deeper, the breath sometimes becomes shorter. So it's possible that there is a slight progression here from the long breath to the short breath. It's also possible that it's just a way of explaining the breath meditation here. Now the next step here then, after the very basic awareness of the breath itself, he says, he trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of the breath. First of all, I shall breathe in, and then I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of the breath. So here, the whole body, it's literally sabba kaya. Sabba means just that, all the body. And the question is, you can see the word of the breath is actually put in parentheses there. And the reason is because the Pali just says the whole body, you experience the whole body. So some people say, well, that means the whole physical body. Other people say, and the commentary explains this as meaning the whole body of the breath. And the reason is that in Pali, just like in English, the word body is has a very broad meaning here. It can mean a body is like a group or a collection of things, like a corporate body, you say in English. A corporate body, got nothing to do with the physical body, it's a collection of something here. A body of evidence is a collection of evidence, right? These are standard expressions in English. And exactly the same in Pali. The word kaya is very broad. And it makes sense here to understand it as meaning the whole breath. In other words, your awareness is becoming more powerful. Not only are you seeing the breath is short and long, but you are able now to follow the breath from beginning to end. From beginning to end in, from beginning to end out, one breath after the other, your awareness is becoming more powerful. So this is what it means here, that you are seeing the whole body. This is how I understand it, and I'm really just following Ajahn Brahmi, because this is also how he understands it. It's also how the commentary understands it. There's a lot of authority on that side, so I think there's good grounds for that. You are seeing the whole breath. You have awareness of the whole breath as it goes in and out. And you will notice here there's a slight change in the wording. Initially, when breathing in long and breathing out long, he just understands the breathing. Once it comes to experiencing the whole body, it says he trains like this. So what's the difference? How come one is understands and the other one is trains? And I think the reason for that is that once you have established mindfulness and you see the long breath and the short breath, that is natural. It happens by itself. You're able to understand and know that the breath is either long or short quite naturally. You don't have to train to do that. Once you have gotten to the stage where you have mindfulness, it happens by itself. But actually, to see the whole breath from beginning to end, it requires more training. It requires a further improvement of the mindfulness, of the awareness, to be able to follow the breath all the way out, all the way in, all the way out, all the way in. And that, I think, is what is meant here, is that training in meditation which sharpens the awareness on the object. And that is why there is a distinction here. And then comes the next step. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily activity. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily activity. Now, the bodily activity, this is the kaya sankara. Sankara, again, is this word which comes up all the time. And literally, the way this is used in the suttas, kaya sankara actually means the breath. Why? Because it is the activity of the body, right? The breath is bound up with the body. It's an activity of the body. So the kaya sankara is the breath. So what you're doing here is you're tranquilizing the breath. This is what this means. And in all of these steps, it is not willpower that you're using to tranquilize the breath. It is not willpower that you're using to have an awareness of the breath. What it is, you're allowing a process to happen all by itself. When you start to be able to have awareness of the breath and you're focusing on the breath, without any effort, just effortlessly, then things start to calm down all by themselves. There's nothing you have to do. There's no willpower required, no input from you required. It is a natural process. And that is how you want to meditate, because it is so easy. It is so peaceful. It is so relaxing and it is so beautiful. Huh? And there's just a sense of comfort all the way through her. So this is the meditation on the breath, the initial stages of the meditation on the breath. So it is a natural process, and that is how this part comes. And this we will see later on. I was asked the question here by somebody early today, and this is a good time to maybe to respond to that question. And this first part here, this is equivalent to the body contemplation in the Satipatthana Sutta. Unfortunately, I abbreviated this sutta a little bit in a slightly stupid way, because it's difficult to see how that works with the way I abbreviated it. But this first part is basically is equivalent to the body contemplation of the Satipatthana Sutta. And each one of these, there are like four exercises, four times. And each set of four exercises, if you like, I'm not sure if exercise is a good word, but each set of four ways of doing the breath meditation is equivalent to each of the four Satipatthanas. So the first one is the body Satipatthana, the next one is the feeling Satipatthana, then you have the mind Satipatthana. Satipatthana is like the focus of mindfulness. And the last one is the Dhammanupassana, or the Dhamma Satipatthana. So I hope that answers that question that was asked of me. But so far, we've only looked at the body contemplation, because the breath is an aspect of the body. It belongs to the body. So that is just the first aspect there of mindfulness of breathing, very important sutta, as I said before. And I think I will leave it there just to allow those things to sink in a little bit. And I will take it up again tomorrow morning when we continue with these things. I don't think I'm going to be finishing all the suttas in here, but it doesn't matter. We just do what we can do, and then we enjoy that instead, because otherwise we're just pushing things too much. So I'll put the Anapanasati Sutta aside for now, and I will answer some questions instead for the rest of the evening. So before I do that, are there any questions on the Anapanasati Sutta that people would like to ask? Everybody happy? Yeah? Everything clear? No problems? Okay, good. I'm very happy to see that. That's good news. So now, usually what happens at this stage is that once we got into the questions and answers, so far we've been very focused on meditation practice, and not only on meditation, but on very specific meditation issues like overcoming defilements and the mindfulness of breathing. And I have to warn you, now the discussion is probably going to expand out and become very broad. So this becomes more like, becomes slightly different now when we start with the Q's and A's. You are certainly welcome if you want to leave the hall at any stage. Please feel free to do so. You don't have to take part, as I mentioned before, in everything here. If you're interested, you're certainly welcome to stay as well here. So let us see what these questions have to say. So this is the first one. This question is not related to the sutta. I told you I was going to say it was going to spread out here. So please answer this only if you have the time. Okay, yeah, I think we have the time now. What is the difference between sanya and vijnana? Okay, then there's a nice saying here, may you attain nibbana in this life. Wow, okay, that's very kind of you to say that. So what is the difference between sanya and vijnana? Okay, well, the thing is that some of these categories that we have in Buddhism, like sanya, vijnana, vedana, first of all, sanya is usually translated into English as perception. It is how we perceive the world, our ability to make sense of the world, to classify things, to divide things up, and to understand the world. That's sanya. Vijnana basically is usually translated as consciousness or awareness. It's our ability to be aware at all, to even know that things exist. So it is the knowing aspect. So one is the knowing aspect. The other one is more like the dividing aspect that makes sense of things. But to understand these things, and you have to understand that the mind is really a whole thing. Yeah? Mind is one thing, it's a unity. And these things are not really divisible in reality. In your mind, you cannot divide out perception on one hand and consciousness on another and say that these are completely different things. They are not. This is just done for the purpose of insight meditation, to be able to understand your own mind and how the mind works and how it functions. That is why we do this division. In reality, sanya and vijnana always go together, and they really are artificial abstractions that we do for the purpose of focusing on particular aspects of the mind. These are about aspects of the mind, not about independent entities as such. So, sanya is that aspect of the mind that is able to differentiate and is defined in the suttas. For example, you are aware of green, you are aware of red, you are aware of yellow. And how are you able to distinguish between these colors? Sanya, perception is the reason. How can you distinguish between anything in life? How can you distinguish between basically anything? You know, this category is very, very, very broad. How do you distinguish between a bamboo floor like we have here and a Jarrah floor? Perception. How do you distinguish between the retreat center and your house? Perception. How do you distinguish between Buddhism and Christianity? Perception. How do you make sense of this world in general? Perception. It's all about perception. The ability to distinguish and classify and understand what is happening around you is all about perception. It's a very, very broad category that we classify things into. Consciousness, on the other hand, is about knowing. It's the ability to know things. The awareness, there's the awareness of things around you. And both perception and consciousness are, according to the Buddhism, impermanent. Our perception changes. Let's take some examples of perception changing. Who are your friends and who are your enemies in life? Now that distinction between friends and enemies and neutral people is a matter of perception. This changes over time. People who used to be your friends have now become neutral people. People who used to be your enemies are perhaps now your friends. And perception changes. Sometimes you are depressed. That's one kind of perception. Other times you are happy. That's another type of perception. These things change. So perception is impermanent. And the same thing is true of knowing, vijnana. Vijnana is also impermanent. It's impermanent in the sense that consciousness of different objects is actually of a different class, of a different type. And only when you get into very deep meditation is it possible to see that consciousness itself is like granular. It is discrete. It stops, comes and stops, and it varies according to the object that you have. So anyway, that gives you a rough idea of the difference between these things. But please remember that these are not different entities. They are different aspects of one thing, the one thing that we call the mind. Sanya and vijnana, perception and consciousness. Yes, Jake. Yeah. Discrimination. Yeah, I think it probably can. Discrimination. Yeah, I think it probably can. I think it probably could. Because basically that's what it's about. It's ability to distinguish things and to put things apart and to understand one side and another side. So I think discrimination might be okay. So, yeah, I think it might work. I've never seen it used that way. Sometimes sanya is called cognition. It's sometimes translated as cognition. You cognize something. Perception. Discrimination. Yeah, I'm not sure about that, Jake. I think I'll have to think about it a little bit. I don't want to commit myself too fast because it's always a dangerous thing to do. So, but possibly you might be right. Okay, so next one here. Okay, thank you for your insight and enthusiasm. It's very kind of you to say that. what I don't understand is why, if thoughts of ill will and frustration and negativity lead people to so much suffering in both this life and the next, why are they the default or automatic behavior in so many people? When I do metta meditation, I often have overwhelming sadness for all the suffering in the world. Has human life always been like this? I think the answer to that is yes. And I think the reason, I mean, this is one of the fascinating things I find when you read the word of the Buddha. This is the word of the Buddha. It's 2,500 years old. It happened in a very different culture from an Australian culture, at a very different time. And yet, when you read the suttas, you realize that human beings were just the same then as they are now. So humanity doesn't really change. People have always been like this. We are run by desires and by craving. We are overwhelmed sometimes by anger and negativity and sadness and all these things. And yes, it's always been, I think it's always been like that. This is what life is, basically. Life is these things. So I think the answer to that one is yes. And then you're asking here, why are they the default or automatic behavior in so many people? And the reason is that people, although they are painful, although they lead to pain, the reason is you have all these habits from the past that you carry along with you, your habitual reactions to things around you. And because they're habits, people don't know how to get out of them. They don't understand that there is an alternative way of looking, that there is a way of being where you don't have to be angry, you don't have to have desires, you don't have to have craving. There is an alternative to this. And this is very hard to see unless somebody is able to point it out to you. Not only that, but also remember that there is a certain satisfaction in craving. Why do we crave in the first place? Because we think it's going to lead to our happiness. We think there's a certain amount of happiness out there. That's why we crave. When you have a desire arise in your mind, then look at that. And what you will see is that there is a promise of happiness is part of that desire. Desire comes with a promise of happiness. So, because the promise of happiness comes with a desire, that's what it feels like inside of you. There's happiness to be had here. How then do you understand that actually it is suffering? Well, you have to look at things in an entirely new way. And unless somebody points that out to you, it is incredibly hard to see for yourself. And that is why people keep doing these things again and again and again. Going around from birth to birth, from life to life, never really finding a release from these things. It is very hard to see. And that is why sometimes it is very useful to have people in the world, like people who are like spiritual geniuses like the Buddha, who can point you the way and say, there is an alternative. There is a way out. There is a way of ending suffering. By yourself, you might never see it. So sometimes it is incredibly useful to have that sort of person. And it's just like if you have a toothache, you go to the dentist. If you have a problem with your body, you go to the doctor. If you want to build a house, you go to an architect. You go to the professional. And just like in those instances there are professionals, there are also professionals in the spiritual realm. And the Buddha, as far as I'm concerned, is one such height of professionalism in the realm of spirituality. So that's where you go to find a solution to these very insidious and deep-rooted problems in life. And then you say that when you do metta meditation, you often have an overwhelming sadness for all the suffering in the world. Well, what I suggest that you do, if you have a lot of feel a lot of sadness for the suffering in the world, the reason you do that is perhaps because you're focusing too much on the suffering. Remember that when you focus on the suffering, what you give rise to then is really more like compassion rather than metta. You see the suffering and you feel it's like your heartache inside. It's like a trembling for the welfare of beings, as it says in the suttas. But try instead to focus on the goodness in people around you instead. When you focus on the goodness, you feel happiness inside. You don't feel sadness. And there is a lot of goodness out there in the world. There's a lot of good people in the Buddhist society of Western Australia, a lot of good people coming on retreats like this, a lot of good people living in the Buddhist monasteries around. focus on those beautiful qualities. And when you see the beautiful qualities, then you have a sense of metta. You feel a sense of, wow, how wonderful that is. May you really be happy, you know, the wonderful people out there. And then that is a very positive feeling. It is true that compassion sometimes can lead to sadness. And when you see how the Buddha structured the Brahma Viharas. The Brahma Viharas are the four like sublime emotions, if you like. Metta comes first and compassion comes second. Why does metta come first? And I said the reason is because compassion is more difficult, because it can lead to sadness. It can lead to maybe, or there's too much suffering in the world. So first establish the metta where you rejoice in the goodness of other people, where you feel a sense of happiness that there is such good qualities around. And then you can move on to the compassion afterwards. So you can avoid that sadness perhaps. So I hope that answers your question. If you have any follow-ups, you please just ask at any time while we're here. So, next one here is, can you have an imaginary person to start metta meditation? And I would say, yes, you can have an imaginary person. In fact, and this is one of the suttas that I would like to read later on, is that when the Buddha explains the metta meditation in the suttas, this is true, this is very advanced metta meditation, but still, the way it is explained is that you have metta towards a certain direction. You don't have metta towards any particular being, but to a certain direction. And of course, if you have it to a certain direction, it doesn't mean that direction as such, but it means all the beings in that direction. And of course, all the beings in a particular direction, they are imaginary people, imaginary animals, imaginary anything. So you just remind yourself, all the beings out there, all the people with good hearts going around in their lives, at the same time experiencing suffering. Don't overdo the suffering part so you become sad. But all those good people out there, may you be well, may you be happy, may things go well with you. So it's just a direction. And sometimes it can be very useful to have an imaginary person, because if it is a person you know, very often the baggage that we have with the people we know will often interfere with the sense of metta and the sense of compassion that we have. It interferes because the baggage often brings up maybe perceptions that are not so nice, that are not so easy, that we don't really enjoy. And because of that, an imaginary person can be very useful. So please use an imaginary person. Just think of an ordinary person out there, somebody you never met, a faceless person, and think of what their life is like, and then wish them well, and see what happens. And the most important thing is not what kind of person you use, or no person, or animal, or whatever it is. What is important is the kind of feeling, emotion that it gives rise to inside of you. If it does give rise to the sense of metta, if you're able to give rise to those good feelings, then you know you're on a roll. You're doing the right thing here. You're going the right direction. And that is how you know whether you're doing the right thing here. So try that and see what happens. Okay, so here we have another one regarding Majjhima Nikaya 20. That's the one we did today, the stilling of thoughts. If you see the suffering of desire and ill will, method 2, doesn't that naturally lead to giving up with regarding giving up will regarding painful desire and ill will? Yes, that's exactly right, precisely. So if you see the suffering of desire and ill will, yes, it leads to the giving up of regarding of precisely desire and ill will. It just happens, it just disappears by itself because you understand the suffering. Of course, you have to understand it deeply. Only then does it actually disappear. To give up the will towards a painful desire or ill will directly, does one have to know what will is? Or can one just infer that the going out of the mind to experience painful thought is by something called will, and not going out means will has stopped? some thoughts. Okay. Basically, I don't think you have to worry too much about the will at that particular stage. You don't have to think too much about the will in terms of the negative thoughts or the thoughts that are defiled. All you have to do is really to think about, to understand that these things are negative, that they have negative consequences. Don't worry so much about the will at this particular point. It's probably too early in the meditation or too early in the spiritual development. Rather, try instead just to understand the danger in these particular thoughts. Try to understand how they lead to suffering for yourself and others. That is really what it's all about. And once you understand that, they will just disappear by themselves. You don't have to really worry about the will very much at this particular stage. As you say, the will basically will disappear by itself. You don't want those things anymore, so the will not go in that direction. The mind will not incline in that direction. And that means your will is going somewhere else because you know it is the wrong place. It's a painful place to go. Does that make sense? I hope that makes sense. I hope I was able to explain that properly. Anyway, I'll move on to the next one. Okay, the Sigala Sutta, worshipping the six directions. What direction is nadir and zenit? Nadir and zenit, I think, is just up, isn't it? Zenit is up and nadir is down or something like that. Is that right? Yeah, okay. So those are the directions. It's up and down. So the idea is that you have like the six directions or the four directions of the compass, north, east, west, and south, and then you have up and down. So then all directions are included. So that's how you worship the six directions. Okay? Okay. I too have a great fondness for reading the suttas and appreciate your explanations of them very much. Regarding AN 301, the soil remover extract, and Majjhima 106, conducive to the imperturbable extract. I note that what are being used are not Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations. Okay. Do you consider these translations to be a more authentic rendering from the Pali than Bhikkhu Bodhi's? Actually, the Majjhima, Anguttara 3 is 101, the soil remover that I was just reading actually is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. Because this is actually a new translation coming out very soon. I have actually been helping Bhikkhu Bodhi with that translation myself. So I have all the files on my computer in the monastery, not my computer, the monastery computer. And because of that, I have actually been able to print out for you that what you're seeing there what is going to come out in a few months' time, published by Wisdom Publication, translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi. That actually is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. And the other one, conducive to the imperturbable, I think that I may have made a change or two in that one when I put in there. That may be the reason why it's changed. And I think what I did there, I put in, let's have a quick look now so I don't get this wrong. I think I said, do not be heedless. Practice jhana, Ananda. I think in the English translation, in the Majjhima Nikaya, it says, meditate, monks, don't be heedless. And I have changed that to practice jhana, monks, don't be heedless. And the reason I have done that is because the word for meditation there is jayati. And the word jayati is directly related to jhana. And I think that even though it may not be exactly equivalent to jhana, it essentially means the same thing. So it is the verbal equivalent to the noun jhana. So it means do jhana, basically. So that's why I translated it as jhana. It's much more precise that way, because then you know what you're talking about. Meditate is like a bit sort of woolly. You're not really sure what it actually means. So that is the reasoning behind that. And the thing about translating is very, very hard and very difficult. And somebody like, even somebody like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who was a very skilled translator, very good at these things, and I respect him enormously for his translation. Nobody is ever going to produce a perfect translation. It is virtually impossible. There's too many things to take into account. So when I read Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, there's always some things that I disagree with in his translations. It doesn't mean that I think he's a bad translator. Far from it. I would have made many more mistakes, no doubt myself, if I were to translate these things. But the point is simply that nobody's perfect. And for that reason, it's good sometimes to actually show that there are alternatives in these things. And that is one of the reasons why I like to do sutta readings and sutta retreats and study these things on my own. Okay, next one. My body is heavy, but my mind is light. I see purple lights and faces. Why is this? Okay, that's wonderful. That sounds to me like a very nice thing. If your mind is light, it's a great thing. If your body is heavy, it doesn't really matter so much. Usually the body will tend to be light as well when your mind is light. Usually it goes together. But maybe there is a particular reason why your body is not so well. But if your mind is light, that is what really matters. If your mind is light, it means that you are at ease, you are relaxed, you're feeling good about yourself. And it's great. Purple lights and faces, why is that? It's very difficult to know why, but it's a very common experience in meditation for people to see things that you don't normally see in ordinary life. When the mind starts to become peaceful, sometimes the mind starts to create things, create images, create all kinds of things. It's very common for people to have unusual experiences in meditation. So if you see purple lights and faces, don't worry too much about that. Go back to your meditation subject. If your mind really is feeling light and the breath is there, go back to the breath and stay with the breath and then see what happens as you go deeper and deeper. And what will happen is that eventually those faces and purple lights, they will tend to disappear. Why? Because you're becoming so peaceful that those distractions just fade away by themselves. So it's neither a good thing nor a bad thing, but don't worry too much about it. Please explain how the Buddha saw his previous lives when we are taught that there is no soul as such that continues on from one life to the next. Also, Ajahn Brahm has called it a stream of consciousness. But why would that stream be remembered? Thank you. Okay, so and this is one of those conundrums which is very, for most people, it's very hard to sort of get your mind around. How can there be rebirth when there is no soul? And you will see that people who argue sometimes against the Buddha's teachings, they will see, you believe in rebirth, but you know this. If you believe in rebirth, you also have to believe in soul. These two things go together. But the point is that, no, it is not the case. From the Buddhist point of view, it is precisely the stream of consciousness is the explanation for how rebirth can happen without a soul. In other words, a stream of consciousness means that it's just like a river. Imagine a river. Now, a river, two moments in that river are never exactly the same. If you look at a certain spot in the river, it is ever changing. The water molecules, the water that is there, is moving all the time. Two consecutive moments are never exactly the same. And yet, there is continuity in that river. That river doesn't change at random. It changes according to certain patterns in certain way. It isn't suddenly a small stream and the next moment a massive river. It changes gradually according to certain causes and conditions. And the same thing is true of the stream of consciousness. The stream of consciousness, there is change all the time, but there is also continuity. The mind is a continuous thing. If you think of your life in this life, you know that the person you are now and the person you were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, there is a sense of continuity. You recognize who you were 30 years ago, and yet there is also change. The mind has changed, the way you think has changed, many things have changed, but there is also continuity here. And this sense of change and continuity that you see within this life is the same change and continuity that you see across lives. It's no different. And that's why when you come into a future life and you, let's say you're able to remember your past life, you can see that continuity just as you can see the continuity in this life. So you know, yes, that was you there. That was part of the same stream of consciousness that is existing now in my present life. It goes across lifetimes. So the point is, there is no need for a soul. There is no need for a permanent entity. All there is need is this stream of consciousness that has a certain continuity to it, yet at the same time is always changing. Yeah. It's hard to get your mind around that one. It is not a very simple concept. And it's really only when you see the idea of non-self fully that one can appreciate these kind of very profound concepts. Happy with that answer? Yeah? Okay. It's almost 9:15, but there's still a few questions left. Please explain what Buddhism thinks about angels. Okay. Angels is a Christian word, right? So I cannot really say. It's difficult to know whether there is a direct relations between Buddhist ideas of angels and Christian ideas of angels. But the Buddhist idea of an angel is really, we have this idea of devas. Devas are like divine beings, if you like, or beings that exist in a higher realm. And they are no different from us. In fact, we can be reborn as devas ourselves in a future life if you just do the right kind of karma, the right kind of positive karma to get you there in the future. So angels are just that from a Buddhist point of view. They are like beings who have done lots of good karma, good actions in the past, and therefore have been reborn in happy circumstances. The word deva is derived from diva, which means like day, which means like shining. So they are literally shining beings. They shine. Just like an angel, angels would tend to shine in the same way the devas or the angels of Buddhism also shine. And sometimes in Christianity they talk about, for example, guardian angels, people who have like an angel that looks after them. And the same thing can happen in Buddhism. Sometimes the devas will look after a person. If a person is very pure-hearted and very kind and very good, the devas are said sometimes to look after that person and help them if they get into problems or difficulties. So the idea of a guardian angel also actually exists in Buddhism as well. So there is a lot of similarity there between the two. So I'm not sure if that is exactly what you wanted to know, but I think that's the best I can do for now. So I will go a little bit longer now, just a few questions left. So if you probably take another 10 minutes or so, I'm going to go a little bit over time. So you're welcome to stay if you like. And again, if you wish to leave, please do so. So next one here. Please explain more how to establish a peaceful mind before focusing on the breath. Okay, so the idea here about establishing a peaceful mind, and this is the thing that I've sort of been repeating throughout this retreat, is that it's all about overcoming the defilements. It's the defilements that stop you from peace. Why is it that defilements stop you from peace? If you have a desire, if there's something you want, a craving, then the mind goes into that object. A craving is always something in the future. It's an object in the future that you're looking for. So the mind goes out into the future. It doesn't stay in the present moment. If you have ill will or you have anger, it is usually the same thing again. You have ill will against somebody. Somebody who is not there, and your mind goes out to that object, out to that person or whatever it is, with the ill will, and you're not able to stay here and now in the present. So defilements always take you away from the present moment, and that is the problem with those defilements. So then what you have to do then is you have to eliminate those defilements. And that is the only way that you really can become peaceful. And that is why I have emphasized so much on the elimination of defilements and methods of eliminating defilements. And that is why the metta and the compassion and the loving kindness, why all of these things are so important. And I recommend you practice these things in daily life. So how do you practice metta in daily life? And this is one of the things that you find also in the suttas. Again, the Buddha said that very often metta is not just about sitting down and wishing people well. Metta is about your actions and your speech every day. How do you speak to people? Do you speak in a kind way? Do you speak with a sense where you wish them well, where you wish to be kind to them? Do you act towards them in kind and nice ways? So act out that kindness in daily life. Even if you don't feel it necessarily very strongly inside of you, act out the kindness. When you act out the kindness in action and speech, you're making it easier in the future to cultivate the kindness also in the mind. So this is how you practice the metta in daily life. Make sure that you act these things out. And then you are cultivating this. And also, another way of doing it is every day, if you have the time and the inclination, practice a little bit of meditation every day. A little bit of metta, a little bit of peace, so that you are building up this store inside of you, of kindness inside of you. Every day you start off on the right foot in the right way, because you have a sense of kindness inside of you. And then you will find that next year when you come back on the retreat, you have, or next time you go on the retreat, whenever that is, you find that you have changed a little bit, and your peace is more profound because your defilements are less at that point. So it is a gradual overcoming of defilements. This is the most important part, to find peace. And apart from that, it is about learning about the importance of peace, learning about how beautiful peace is compared to many other things in life. And the more you understand and you see the importance and you give value to the peace, the more you actually incline in that direction as well. So that's just some small things for you to think about. How and when does Buddhism fit in with Christianity? Okay. Does Buddha believe in God or Jesus Christ? After meditation, we bow to the statue of the Buddha. What is the correct method and what should we be thinking while doing this? Okay. How does Buddhism fit in with Christianity? Well, the answer is that with all religions, they have something in common and they have some differences. And with Christianity, you're also supposed to be kind, you're supposed to be gentle, you're supposed to be moral. In Buddhism, we're supposed to be kind and gentle and moral. So somebody who practices Christianity well is going to be similar to a person who practices Buddhism well. But Buddhism is different in the sense that according to Buddhism, there is no creator God. There's nobody who created us and made us in this world. And also there is no soul according to Buddhism. So in that sense, it's different. So like with so many things in life, there are similarities and there are differences. And it's good to be clear that there are differences. Sometimes you hear these kind of religions which say that they're all just different paths up the same mountain. And I think that's just wishful thinking. They're not all just different paths up the same mountain. Some of the paths lead a little bit up the mountain. Some lead a little bit more and some lead to the summit. And of course, I'm a Buddhist, so I believe that Buddhism leads to the summit of that mountain. And frankly, I do not believe that the other religions lead to the same summit. That's what I believe anyway. So, does the Buddha believe in God or Jesus Christ? No, the Buddha says there is no God. There is no creator God. There are beings in higher realms. There are beings that, you know, we can be reborn as these beings, but those beings too are subject to dying, subject to rebirth, subject to the laws of karma. And there is no final God that you can believe in, according to Buddhism, that created this world and who is there like a father or the mother that you can always go to and always ask for favors or whatever. There is no such thing in Buddhism. And does the Buddha believe in certainly Jesus Christ to the extent that Jesus Christ is a God or is an emanation of God or whatever? I must admit, I don't really know very much about the Christian doctrine. I've never been very interested in it. But to the extent that Jesus Christ is similar to God, to that extent, certainly the Buddha also did not believe in any Jesus Christ. After meditation, we bow to the statue of the Buddha. what is the correct method and what should be the thinking while doing this? I like that question. It's a very important question because sometimes as Buddhists, we get accused of being idol worshippers. We worship idols, these golden statues, and we think that we're kind of bowing down to a golden statue. But that's not really what you're bowing down to. A golden statue is a reminder of something. It is a reminder of the beautiful qualities that the Buddha is supposed to have had and that we are trying to cultivate in yourself, in ourselves. So when you bow down, remember what you're bowing down to is kindness. It's compassion. It is wisdom. It is love. It is all these beautiful qualities. It's peace. All these things that we're trying to cultivate. And because the Buddha is the prime example of those qualities, that is why we bow down to an image which is supposed to represent the Buddha. That is the only reason. You can bow down to anything. What you're really bowing down to is something that is beautiful and that you yourself can cultivate inside of yourself. It doesn't matter how you bow. It's just a way of respecting something beautiful. It is wonderful, in my opinion, to be able to respect something as beautiful as wisdom, as compassion, as kindness. And I am very, very, very happy myself to bow down to those things because I'm hoping myself to be able to grow in those qualities. So it doesn't matter how you do it. What matters is that it is a sense of respect that you're feeling here. The traditional way of bowing is, you know, the way you can see the monks bowing here. You stand on your knees and then you just bow your head down to the ground and you put your arms on the ground as well. Don't worry too much about how you do it. It doesn't matter. What matters is what's in your heart and how you think about it. There's no magic to these things. And of course, the way that people show respect in Australian society is different from how they do it often in traditional Buddhist societies. So sometimes you have to adapt these things a little bit to the Australian way of doing things. And that's fine. I think not only fine, I think we should do that. Otherwise, it's not really going to fit in to Australia. So just do it your own way, whatever feels nice for you, whatever feels respectful, whatever feels kind and good. That's the way to do it. Okay, I am very prone to outbursts of anger, never violent, but little things like people driving too slow. Okay, yeah. Or not being able to find my keys. What would be a good way to move away from this behavior? Okay, so I think what you have to understand that the anger is not going to help very much. And I think this is one of the key understandings of why anger really is useless. It's not going to change the situation. You're not going to find the keys any faster if you get angry. You're not going to make the other person drive faster just because you get angry. Anger doesn't work, basically. That's why it's useless. In fact, it's worse than useless. It usually makes the situation much worse. If you get angry, not only don't you find your keys, but you also have the suffering of that anger on top of that. So if you reflect that it is useless, it's not going to change, and in fact it makes your life miserable at the same time, then say, why am I doing this for? This is pointless. I should stop doing this. And a simple thing like that is often sufficient to actually overcome that anger. It doesn't change people. It doesn't do anything for you. And the same thing with often it is people in our lives that we get angry with. Remember, people don't change because you get angry. People change because they feel that you have compassion and kindness towards them. And then when they see that they are at fault because they are open to maybe to admonishment, or they're open to having their faults pointed out because you're not angry, because you're kind. That is when people change. They don't change because you get angry. So angry, really, very often, almost always, I would say, is not very useful. It doesn't work. It's counterproductive. Understand that it's counterproductive. Understand that you suffer because of anger. And then gradually let go of it. It doesn't happen overnight. Next time you lose the keys, you might still get a bit angry. It's okay. Don't blame yourself for that. But just understand that it doesn't work. And then over time, next time you go on retreat, maybe you are slightly less angry because of those keys that you lost. And then you have already gone a long way because of that. So that would be a very good thing indeed. Okay, so quickly go through the last ones here. Please don't ring that bell. It's shattering the mind when the mind is peaceful. Unnecessary suffering here. Okay. Maybe we need another bell which is more kind of smooth and not so kind of so harsh. Maybe we can find a smoother bell. We had a small bell here before that was a bit more sonorous. This one is a bit too maybe a bit too rough in the tones. Yeah. So we'll try to find a nicer bell for you. Sorry about that. That's life. You know, life is suffering, as they say. So this is what happens. What of the past, future, and fantasy in relation to the Buddhist idea of dividing thought into two classes? Okay, so basically, most of the time when you think about the past, or you think about the future, or you fantasize, it is due usually to some kind of desire. It is usually craving that drives you into these things. And very often that craving might be you don't enjoy the present moment very much. Because you don't enjoy the present moment, you fantasize about all kinds of stuff. Not necessarily a very bad fantasy or a dangerous one, but because you're not enjoying the present moment. So what you have to do is you have to learn to enjoy being just here, just now. And that is why I emphasize just finding the peace and enjoying the sense of peace in the present moment. If you can see the beauty of the peace, then fantasizing starts to diminish. Past and future start to diminish because you feel the beauty of being here, right now. That is also why I think it is useful to practice metta, because metta gives rise to good feelings. And when you feel good inside of you, there's no need anymore for escaping into fantasy, escaping into future, escaping into the past. Usually these are a result of suffering, not being happy in the present, so you escape by going into somewhere else. So again, it is a relation. It relates to desire. Desire is twofold. Either it is a desire that's something you want to get, so you think about the thing you want to get, or it is an escape from the present, but also desire. You want to escape from suffering. That's also a desire. So you move into the past, the future, or into fantasy. Please organize long retreats on long weekends. Okay, yeah, maybe we can do that at some stage. We'll see what happens, see how things go. How does the concept of attachment and non-self relate to sensual desire? Okay, so attachment, basically the reason why you attach to things is because you think that that thing that you're attaching to is going to give you some satisfaction and fulfillment in life. That's why you attach to things. So if you, for example, you have a partner in life, a very nice partner who's always around and always kind and always helpful, you attach to that person because this partner gives you so much satisfaction and happiness in life. And that's why we attach to people, because they give us something that we give us basically a satisfaction of our desires. So attachment is basically a strategy of holding on to the things that are going to fulfill our desires. And you see that in what is called dependent origination in Buddhism. You have, first of all, you have feeling. From feeling comes craving. If a person feels, sometimes you feel good things, sometimes you feel bad things. Because you want the good feelings, you crave, you have desire. Because you want to get away from the bad feelings, you crave to get away from those. And that craving, in turn, leads to attachment, because attachment is like a strategy to satisfy the craving. You're holding on to things that is going to satisfy things for you. So craving and attachment are very, very closely related to each other, and they belong with each other. And sensual desire is exactly the same thing here. How does the concept of non-self relate to sensual desire? That is a question I have never received before, I think. I'm not sure exactly how to answer that one. How does it relate? Well, basically the way it relates is that one of the ways it relates, and probably many ways you can answer that question, but one of the ways it relates is that desire that you have here and now are a consequence of the habits you had in the past. That's why desires arise here and now. They're not a consequence of a self. They're not a consequence of you having done something personally, but they're a consequence of causes and conditions in the past That's why you have sensual desire. So don't blame yourself if you have desires, because really there isn't much you can do about it right here, right now. You have to gradually wean yourself off these desires, and that's how you get rid of it. So don't blame yourself, and that is probably one of the ways in which non-self relates to desires. Okay, I'm feeling quite tired now, so I think I'm very glad that was the last question. So very good. So let us just then pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha and then call it a day here.